From the basement studios of the Atlantic Voice, this is the Atlantic Voice Podcast, 3,000 miles of opinion. This is the Atlantic Voice Podcast. I'm Zeph.
And I'm Eric.
We're here in the basement studio. We have a full menu today. We have a more regular show, even though we are in the midst of releasing our specials.
Do we have such a thing as a regular show?
I'd like to think so. I like to think a run-of-the-mill potpourri of thoughts and amusing anecdotes.
Covering semi-current events.
Semi-current events. Although I know, and we do have a full list to get straight to, which we're going to get to. But I do want to say one thing. I don't want to talk about it, but I do want to just throw out there that I'm unhappy that my desire to talk about the drive-by shooting of the circus elephant got the kibosh from our menu of stories. Well, I did feel that apparently a circus elephant was shot in a drive-by shooting in Alabama. And there was, you know, some outrage down there about it. And I just felt there was room for comedic potential, but you decided you didn't want to talk about that.
Well, duly noted.
Okay, fair enough. You're not concerned that, you know, Dumbo or Baba were shot randomly? No, okay.
Not especially.
Not especially.
Listen, to start off, we do have to say a couple words. This has been a heck of a week. As the I was listening on the radio, they said, you know, when you come through a week where an Elvis impersonator sending rice and poison to the president is the least publicized story, you know, that's quite a week you came through. Most obviously, then the Boston Marathon and all the tragedy up there and what's gone on since. To start off, we have a number of listeners in the New England area, but of course the Boston, I mean, many number of people could be involved.
You actually have someone who was actually in the marathon.
Yeah, a friend of a friend kind of thing who was there, who was finished well before all this sort of stuff happened. But, you know, to go out to anybody who'd be listening, who it matters, you know, obviously our thoughts and prayers are with the injured and the families of those who are killed. You know, you're talking about, while the actual death toll is small for what you'd think a bombing would lead to, but there's a tremendous, you know, a large number of people, including, I think last I saw, at least 60 of the 200 or so people that were injured are still actually in the hospital, so you're talking about serious things they have to deal with. But, you know, on the bright side, I mean, a lot of people have already talked about how strong and resilient Boston is and United States is, and you know, so we don't really need to say that again, but it's certain that, you know, given the nature of what it is, you know, there's no doubt that next year that marathon is going to be covered with people. You know, like, it's going to not only, you know, I'm sure everybody's going to want to get in there to run, to make their statement about running, but there's going to be, everybody's going to want to be there.
Let me ask you a question about the Boston Marathon. And obviously I think this past weekend, depending when you end up listening to this, we had the London Marathon, which was which has always been a huge event back in England. Is the Boston Marathon a sort of marathon where people run in, like, costumes? Or is it a very serious marathon?
No, I don't think it's either. I mean, it's a fun event. It's, you know, it's a community event. You know, that marathon is 120 years old. I mean, like, can you imagine 120?
Yeah.
I mean, like, people weren't even barely doing marathons 120 years ago. It was an era in which it was thought that, you know, it might be a horribly dangerous thing to run the marathon, and nowadays everybody does it. But it's you know, I think there's probably some of that. I definitely saw some folks who were in military stuff, but not like the full goof, though. I mean,
people wearing, like, duck outfits and stuff like that. I mean, marathons and all these sort of things do tend to attract that group.
Yeah, well, but the Boston Marathon is a marathon you have to qualify for.
So it's a serious,
a lot of people
run legit
other things to get in there. Yeah, so I think the people who end up going there, it's much less than, you know, some random marathon out west in Phoenix where somebody'd say, well, just go out there and have fun because anybody can get into it. This is not an anybody can get into it kind of marathon, so it is kind of a big deal. But, you know, sorry to say, obviously going to be tons of people in it next year. And so to the extent the object of any terrorist is to instill fear in people, you know, you can say right out of the gate it's a miserable failure in this regard, because I don't think it's going to lead anybody to be afraid of being out there and doing the exact same thing a year from now. You know, it's sort of a weird thing that there's – we're a humor podcast. There's only so much you can say about that stuff, so I don't want to bring all to that. And while it's not –
although I did warn you in advance, I do have a Saddam Hussein joke that I can tie into the marathon.
We'll get to that in a second. But the while there's obviously not anything funny about this, you can see the seeds of things that are funny about it. Like, I'm not ready to tell jokes about it, but, you know, when you're dealing with the apparent obliviousness of these people as to their exposure and things like that. You know, the fact that, you know, the guy walking around with the backwards baseball cap and, you know, how sort of obvious that is, not even like an effort to disguise yourself, really. you know, the use of cookware for bomb making, you know, the fact that, you know, they were discovered on that 7-Eleven videotape. The 7-Eleven was robbed, and it was originally thought that they were the robbers. It turns out they weren't the people who robbed the 7-Eleven.
Just there at the time.
Well, on the same film, not even the same time. Oh. So when they examine the film associated with the robbery, they're like, hey, wait, those are the people we're looking for. You know, the whole exercise of the 24-hour news cycle and, you know, CNN and all the other channels spending all day, especially Friday when they had that whole lockdown, just routinely regurgitating the same stories, you know, the aunts and uncles that we've seen in these press releases with their crazy rants one way or the other, either they're the biggest losers ever or maybe they were framed according to the woman up in Canada.
It's 15 minutes of fame for everyone, isn't it?
Like everybody's jumping in there to say something like that. There's all these little bits and pieces, and I don't know, you know, maybe by the time that it feels comfortable to make full-on jokes about these things, nobody will want to talk about it anymore. But,
no.
You know, I've marked them down in the notebook for adequate ridicule as we get further into the process.
It is interesting, though. You did mention CNN, and I'm going to pick on just the media in general. And you used the word earlier, and this is sort of like the semi-serious part of the podcast right here. I'm still not sure that these characters were terrorists. And what I'm saying is we are in an age where, well, what exactly does it mean if you're a terrorist? Because normally terrorists, you know, they do their thing and then they issue a statement that we're striking in the name of whatever it may be. But this lot didn't do that. Then they had aunts and uncles giving press conferences and ranting and raving away. They just didn't seem to be very terroristic.
Well, you know, it depends.
Even though they're from Chechnya, which has lots of terrorists and apparently one of them has Islamic beliefs and another guy posted in a website they didn't have any friends in America. That's slightly different from, you know, down with America or down with Israeli or with the IRA, down with the British government. Yeah. I mean, it's all a bit sort of random.
Well, that's, I mean, you do.
But the TV, you're all quick, oh, terrorists, because it's almost like that's the thing that you immediately default to nowadays.
Well, it depends upon how you define it, right? You know, because the notion is, I think over the past bunch of years, because of that, we tend to equate terrorism with sort of
random acts of violence?
Well, no. I would think that's the classic meaning of it, right? You know, like, you know, the terrorist acts of, what's the name of the guy? Guy Fawkes, right? You know, he would have had.
Yeah, but he was trying to get rid of the government.
Yeah, well, he had his own agenda, but it wasn't like he was a part of a government-sponsored thing. See, the thing is, after coming out of September 11th and all that sort of stuff, it's been equated with, it's like a half step away from a nation-on-nation war. It's a notion of a set of people out there in some other place who are training and doing all these things to come and attack through terrorist actions. The truth is, I don't think that's not really the meaning of terrorism. I mean, if you get down to the base of it, the notion is it's committing of these crimes that are at random without the goal of, you're not targeting people to kill them because you want to steal something from them or because you have a revenge against a particular people. You are using crimes and violence in a way to inspire terror amongst your larger audience. And in that sense, that's very much what they were. Now, whether they were that's what they were because they're stupid and they, you know, they're short-sighted or, you know, or it's because they had a Muslim belief or whatever it was, at the end of the day, that's what it was. I mean, Timothy McVeigh would be considered a terrorist, but it was all based on his own little personal agenda of anti-government stuff. Now, these guys, they had some motivation, and their motivation, whatever it was not directed at the people who were there at the race. It was directed at making some sort of statement to the world at large. You know,
that was my point, though. This is my point with terrorists, is I feel like they need to have a statement. And these two guys really didn't seem to me to have a statement. It's all been a bit sort of very sort of amateurish. Now, I understand what you're saying is that ultimately any random act of violence ultimately terrorizes a society. But what I'm saying is, I always get a bit nervy when the media, I'm having a pop at the media here, they roll out the word terrorism and all of a sudden it is then reframing the conversation. Right now, with what I know, I equate these two dudes with, you know, the sort of kid that goes in and shoots kids in high school.
Yeah, well,
or that guy in the summer that shot up the cinema. Now, no one was sitting around going he was an anti-Hollywood terrorist because he attacked the Batman movie. Do you know what I mean? People just immediately dismissed him as some sort of nut job. Because these two are Chechnyans, because one of them was posted that, you know, he's into Islam, I just found it interesting that basically even by day two, the White House were coming on going, act of terror, terrorists. And I'm just like, sometimes I almost feel like all that language almost gets in the way of, look, these are two evil people, get them off the street, get them done, and everyone goes back to their regular life. I almost feel that if you start using that word, you end up as a media causing the same kind of worry in the population that the terrorists want to do.
It's a fair point. I mean,
do you know what I mean?
Yeah,
that was my concern.
You know, there's an argument that legitimizes it. Maybe there's an argument that legitimizes it because of that level of attention. It will inspire the next person to do that sort of stuff. But that's, I think, actually, as we get into this, it's not gonna be like September 11th in the sense of a big foreign directed effort by Al Qaeda. But I think it's also not going to turn out to be like a random movie theater thing. I mean, so I think we're already further into the topic than I'm willing to go on this sort of stuff, just because.
Let me say this: somewhere in hell, Saddam Hussein is sitting at his Starbucks, his local Starbucks in hell. He's sitting there having his daily cup of coffee with Hitler, Pinochet, Attila the Hun. He's looking at them going, see, none of this has anything to do with me. You don't get that?
No, I don't.
Well, because last time we were attacked by terrorists, we took out Saddam Hussein. And he ended up having to do with it. So he's sitting there right now in hell with his daily cup of coffee at Starbucks going, look, this has nothing to do with me, in a very defensive way.
I think the fact that you're assuming that...
There's my Saddam Hussein
bit. That hell has Starbucks is the most interesting aspect of that story.
Well, I do want to now have a shot at Starbucks. I went to a Starbucks this week at 2 in the afternoon. I say, can I get a cup of decaf? The woman looks at me and says, we don't brew decaf after 1 o'clock. Not we were out today, but we don't brew decaf after 1 o'clock. We will do you a decaf Americano. And I'm like, isn't that the whole point of decaf?
That's
that
really
I can
weird.
Get a cup of coffee after 1 o'clock. And I don't want to name the Starbucks on air and finger them. But to me, that actually is proof that there's Starbucks in hell, because that's the kind of place where they wouldn't sell you decaf at 2 o'clock in the afternoon.
That is pretty weird. I don't know why you would...
we don't brew decaf after 1 o'clock.
Huh.
And then she said, I will do you a decaf Americano. It wasn't like, oh, we're out, can you wait? It was, we don't brew decaf after 2 o'clock. And I'm standing there in Starbucks where they boast about the fact you can have your coffee 129,000 ways. You just can't get a decaf after 1 in the afternoon.
Well, at least at that one. I wonder if that can't be a regular policy. We should have to look that up. You should have done some research on that topic and seen if this is an actual policy.
Well, I don't know. I got decaf Americano, so my angst immediately went down, and what did I get?
Isn't an Americano like when they make an espresso and they just mix water in with it?
Yeah, so they made me a decaf espresso.
Right, so they could make that by a single cup. That's the thing. The difference is what you're saying is there's no pot of decaf.
Well, that's what,
pull you a regular glass
but
of it.
But wouldn't you use more decaf in the afternoon?
No, I agree with that. I just want to clarify for people who would never have any reason to order Americano, which I wouldn't either.
It's one of the reasons that in hell, Saddam Hussein, Hitler, and Attila the Hun all drink their coffee in the morning. Because they can't get a decaf after 1 o'clock at the Starbucks.
Yeah, with any luck, they can't get... they have to only drink decaf all the time, which would be the true hell of a Starbucks, having to drink it where it's only decaf.
All right, fair enough. On to the next topic.
Yeah, well, you know,
talking of terrorists, you wanted to talk a little bit about Margaret Thatcher, who passed away a couple of weeks ago.
All right, well,
let me say this. She was the target of terrorists on a couple of occasions, and she survived.
Right. So, you know, Margaret Thatcher passes away, right?
Okay, so let me... Serious point about what I was saying before about just terming people terrorists. And I know we're going to talk more about this. I grew up... I was a young kid back in the 70s when the IRA were waging their campaign against the British government on the mainland. And to me, that's terrorism. Everywhere signs saying, look for your bag, be careful in the station, that's terrorism. When they nearly killed Thatcher, they set off a bomb at the Conservative Party conference and took out like 4 floors of the hotel. I mean, they were apparently, you know, yards away from killing her. To me, that's terrorism. An organized group out to get people, out to scare everyone else. That's terrorism.
Well, it'd be
these two other dudes, Random nut jobs. But anyway, that's just me.
To be literal, that's probably an assassination, right? That's not even...
That's an actual targeted
killing. Well, anyway, so, you know what? We have a number of younger listeners, and they might not even know anything about Margaret Thatcher. They could have been born after Margaret Thatcher's there. So I thought just a couple of basic facts. You know, Margaret Thatcher, she was 87 years old. She just passed away. She was the prime minister in Great Britain, United Kingdom, from May of 79 to November of 90. Big stretch. Longest serving prime minister in the 20th century. Apparently, which I did not know.
But. Well, because Tony Blair counts as the next century.
That's right, new century. Yeah. Okay. So, you know, she was part of the Conservative Party, which, you know, people always call you. You said just Tory just a couple of seconds
Tory
ago.
Tory is the other word, you know.
So I was wondering why that was, and so I went and looked up some things on
Tory. Because it's short for conservatory.
No.
Oh.
Not even close. Like, Tory is like a word that goes back to, you know, now some of our more, our older listeners, certainly in the UK, are going to know way more about this than I do, although maybe perhaps you don't.
Well, I don't. But, and I'm of indeterminate middle age.
That's right. Indeterminate middle age. Is that, you know, that's a term that was used on the parties back in, like, the 1670s. It was really like a royalty thing.
It was the Whigs and Tories and all kinds of stuff.
Tory is apparently a derivative of an Irish word for outlaws, because they were on one side of a debate and the Whigs were on the other side, and it was about the legitimacy of Charles II or something. I almost said Carl II, but he wouldn't have been a king. But so it was very interesting that was the Tory party. And when I was looking, it said, well, you know, the Tory party disappeared, you get the Conservative party. But I do wonder, I couldn't figure out when the Conservatives took on the name Tory. Like, it was not a clear line from these people who were dealing with royalty. And, you know, the Whigs, we had Whigs in America as well. And so, like, it was a different era entirely in terms of the politics.
And then somehow that got adopted as
the Tories of the Conservatives. So
I have no idea.
Yeah, all right. So our first...
Although I want to say this, because that I didn't know anything about that until you just explained that to me. I know that earlier in today's episode, you referred to ours as a comedic podcast. But as anyone who is currently wading through our opus analysis of the National Recording Registry, this is also an educational podcast. And I have just been educated.
Yeah, partly anyway.
I understood there would be no math, but apparently I have learned. But I didn't know that.
Yeah, so we'll have to task our research team and our interns on that sort of stuff to figure out the full story of how Tory became. Or, boy, somebody could write in and give us an answer.
That would be great.
Perhaps one of our English listeners could send us something that explained all this stuff better than the Wikipedia page I looked up.
Someone could write in other than my mother, who, bless her, when I say write in, she writes in. Thank you, Mom. She's here right now, so I'm showing her a lot of love.
Not here in the room.
Not here in the room. Oh, God, no.
She's here in the United States. Yes. Yeah, so, you know, the biggest reason I wanted to bring it up is because I was in my junior high school years during when she was there. It, of course, lined up perfectly with Ronald Reagan, almost perfectly with Ronald Reagan in the United States. Ronald Reagan was last 80 to 88, or I guess... Yeah, 80 to 88 was when he was in office. And so I think as an American youth in particular, who wasn't, you know, not reading the New York Times every day or anything like that, I tended to think of her as just the British version of Ronald Reagan, current conservative guy. You know, when they did that Genesis Land of Confusion video, they each had the puppets for all the different characters there, and it sort of equated all this sort of stuff. And I was not, as a youngster, a very big Ronald Reagan fan, and so I don't know that I had any bias against her. But, you know, as I've seen little stories about her coming out since, it seems to me that my impression is that she was much more of a socially polarizing figure than Ronald Reagan was. Certainly had that aspect to him, but it was not like what seemed to be almost like a social seizure in Great Britain at the time of this shift from over to the Conservative Party and her clamping down on things that the way things had gone there. And maybe it's because of the difference of the 70s in Great Britain versus here. All of my long spiel to introduce and say, what was your impression as a youth in England of Margaret Thatcher?
Well, it's funny. You know, I just mentioned the National Recording Registry shows that we did where we talked about the spoken word, and then we'd started music. And there is another episode coming out in the next 2 weeks as we go deeper and deeper into modern music. The most fascinating thing about growing up at that time was Thatcher is one of those... It wasn't just her. It was the 80s. It was unemployment. It was all kinds of different things. But Thatcher had an effect on, and I'm now talking about as a young man, she had an effect on the culture, the popular culture that you digested as a young man. All kinds of rock groups started their careers during that time. And I'm talking about everyone from Duran Duran to U2. And I guarantee if you go through all these different bands' bibliographies, you will find somewhere that they've made some statement song about where they mention the government, or they mention Thatcher, or they talk about unemployment and alienation or whatever it is. And let's face it, no one was doing that in Britain when Tony Blair was prime minister. Mm-hmm. No one's doing that in America, when even when George Bush is president, and he was quite polarizing, depending where you were.
Great.
Thatcher is one of those rare politicians. And I guess the only other one is that guy Putin, that Russian band singing. But that's what I'm saying.
Harking back to some of your original blog.
Yeah, but as a leader of a country, you know you've arrived when pop musicians make money from singing songs about you. And yeah. Thatcher, whether you were for or against her, there was no middle ground with Thatcher. And I sometimes feel, and I don't want to get too deeply into my own personal politics, you have to give her a big shout out. I think the one thing that's got lost in terms of Thatcher's time in charge and everything since, she was the first woman to get voted into the top job in any forward-thinking Western nation. And regardless of what anyone thinks of her politics and her policies, and I've got some strong opinions about them, that fact always seems to get lost a little bit. And if you think, I mean, in a weird way, Thatcher broke a ceiling that America had to wait another 30 years to break with President Obama in terms of not a regular white guy.
Yeah.
I mean, and even in this country, you know, it was, oh, Hillary Clinton, the first president. Well, you know something? Britain did that 35 years ago.
As far as I know, President Obama is a man, so...
Well, he is a man,
that was slightly different, but I understand what you're saying. And you can't...
And to me...
Deny that, the significance of that position.
If you go back 30 years where gender politics was a very different place than it is now, that's still quite an amazing thing.
Do you think this is a different question? If she had not been a man... If she had not been a woman, if she'd been a man, do you think the reaction would have been different? I mean, what was your sense at the time? Was it because it could be partly you get the whole story of like a woman who's in that position is perceived more as a, well, to use bad words, you know, the rhyming with the witch kind of thing, you know. Or the other version is, were people more hands off? I suspect not the latter. I suspect it's, you know, maybe they would have gone at her, they go at her harder because she seems so stern and not like.
I definitely think that if you have a leader who has broken the archetype, your fans, the people that fans, your supporters are even more committed.
Yeah.
So what I'm saying is, if you liked Thatcher, whether deep down inside, as let's say you were a middle-aged white man, let's say you'd always been the most horrible chauvinist all your life, but if you voted Tory and Thatcher was your leader, yes, we were the first party to put gender aside and our leader's a woman. So what I'm saying is, I think the people that liked her were even more hardcore because she'd broken the mold. That being said, if you didn't like her, it was easy to pick on, this is what happens when you put a woman in charge. In the same way that everyone knows now, without getting too far into politics, there's part of the subtext with Obama is race. It's always a subtext.
Right.
And what I'm saying is, even back then, there were a lot of people, well, you know, she's a woman, they can't do it, blah, 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 blah.
Mm-hmm.
Likewise, if you were for her, you were even more, you were even quicker to wrap yourself in, look at this, we've moved beyond our chauvinist things, we've elected a female prime minister, such and such. I do think...
Although I guess the one big difference is that she's on the conservative side, right? So, you know, to the extent people are touting, look at how enlightened we are, the people who are most likely, like, you know, women's lib fans or things like that are going to be on the opposite side of things, whereas in Obama it kind of lines up more, in a more expected fashion.
I know
fashion
exactly what you're saying.
Thing.
Here's the one thing I will say about Margaret Thatcher. I've done a lot of reading the last couple of weeks in reading sort of the obituaries of Margaret Thatcher, and every social media commentator has come out to tout their position and to try and frame her time. I don't think there's any doubt she was a very divisive figure.
Mm-hmm.
I don't think there was any doubt about that. But as a politician, and if you do think back 35 years ago, She was a woman in a man's business, and yet she was the boss for over a decade, and no one ever questioned her.
Well,
that I find that most amazing.
Well, at the point of her exit, I mean, that was her. What led to her exit was a whole bunch of people who used to be working with her saying, "This is too much," right? It was because, like,
but that's always the way it ends,
main
though.
Deputy is the one who said, "I can't go up there and keep doing this sort of stuff." But putting that aside, I totally agree. I mean, because when you think about the fact that the prime minister, for people who don't know, can be recalled anytime. It's not an election. It's not like here where the president
for 4 years.
Years and you got your 4 years. You can be recalled anytime. And so the fact that we, as we started off, she's the longest serving one. And being that divisive, and it was always that divisive, and yet not enough, had enough strength to maintain her power. There wasn't like she could be unseated with all
this. This is the most amazing thing about Thatcher as a politician. Growing up in England in the 80s, and that was the time when I left England to come to America, because growing up in England in the 80s, high unemployment, you know, the future was definitely not rosy if you were a young person, you felt. You know, it was generation whatever, way before generation X and Y.
Right.
You definitely felt like, you know, every younger generation thinks like the older people don't get them. But growing up in the 80s, we definitely felt that, yeah, our country didn't get us. The genius of Thatcher was, at a time when she had divisive policies, policies that were hurting people either with their jobs and economically, her genius is for 11 years, she kept her job because she was able to blame the opposition for everything that was wrong. And that's genius politics.
Yeah.
The other party, who should have been the solution, kept getting collared with the reason that it was all so bad.
Nice.
And that's she was a genius politician. I will give her that.
Yeah, she got it right up there. So when you were, putting aside what your own personal views were, but when you were, you know, a teenager and she was there and all the thinking about the fact that all these bands and things were really on the opposite side,
yes,
like being anti against her kind of thing. Would you say that most of the youth, like if you took a poll of your class in high school or secondary school, whatever that's the right word for it there, would you have said most of the people would have been opposed to her? Because Reagan was a little different because there was a youthful conservative movement at the same time going on in America. And so you didn't have like everybody sort of going against her, and even like in music and things like that, you have a kind of a different mix. You know, maybe your country musicians were going to be more supportive of
you. Know
of
something?
Like
I think it. What's the old saying that all politics is local? All politics depends on your locality.
Right.
I'm from London, at that time a relatively left wing, working class big city, but I was educated at a private school, traditionally quite right wing, and while I was probably in the minority with my own beliefs, I was surrounded by people who didn't think she was that bad.
Right.
So I got to see sort of both things of it. And like I say, I think how you feel about her all depends on where you live. It's like anything in life.
Yeah,
it's like politics now. If you live in Pennsylvania, you feel one way about the government. If you live in North Dakota, you feel another way about the government. If you live in the countryside in England, you feel one way about the government. If you live in an industrial town in the center of England, you feel another way about the government. So again, I think all politics are local, all politics are locality.
Yeah, and plus when you're young and you're in high school, right, and we didn't have the internet or anything like that, and you, like I said, wasn't reading the New York Times every day, so we didn't have a global perspective on things. So really, like, you could have looked around your 100 or so people, kids that you were hanging around with, and that's super local. Like, it's like, you know, like your sense of what's going on.
I do think generationally there was a sense that Thatcher didn't get who you were. So all popular music would take shots at her.
Mm-hmm.
Thatcher was notorious for not liking football.
I was going
to
say
that. She thought everyone that went to football was a thug and a hooligan. So if that was one of your interests, boom. Thatcher was, you know. Back in the 80s when football hooliganism was still bad and it culminated in the Hillsborough disaster, Thatcher was very quick to blame the very same people who ended up being victims, basically saying they brought it upon themselves. So if you were younger, I think it was age before what class you were. If you were younger, you felt that she didn't get the things that made you tick. So likewise, when she went, you were like, you breathed a sigh of relief maybe a little bit.
Yeah. And when she passed, and so it is interesting, so they have the funeral, what they called it, a ceremonial funeral. It wasn't a quote-unquote state funeral, you know, but it still cost a few bucks, and it was kind of close to being, you know, in all in all things except for title, it was sort of a state funeral. And I know that elicited a certain amount of debate. I mean, she still had people coming out to protest her.
I was shocked, though. I was surprised when she passed away at the amount of anger that was still there. Now, again, like I said, I always joke, I'm of indeterminate middle age. It's one thing for people of my age to be angry. But when I saw TV, there were all these, like, 17, 18-year-olds protesting. And I'm thinking, well, you weren't even alive then.
Yeah.
So, seriously, that you don't get to complain about it.
It's, like, the cool thing to do, maybe? Like, you know, yeah, like, you're like, oh, man, but, you know, what, back yeah. in the day, in the 80s, yeah. when the punk was out, they'd go out there and protest. We're going to go out and protest. It's an opportunity.
I was, and it does say something, again, she was such a polarizing figure. And I was surprised that, you know, I think most people would have just gone, yep, glad that one's gone. But people wanted to express that. That being said, I think the majority of people that I've spoken to back in England do have a problem with her being recognized with the way her funeral was. Because at the end of the day, she was prime minister. And prime ministers come and go. There's been a couple since, and there were some before. And you can make arguments about all those different people that they've all had achievements. Are we now going to give every one of these guys a big sending off when they leave?
Yeah, well, it's like we were talking about, because of the fact that somebody could be there for a year, somebody could be there for 10 years, like she
if you
was.
If you turned around now in England and said, we're going to give Tony Blair one of these send offs yeah. when he goes, people are going to go, no way.
Right.
And yet, if you look at Tony Blair's record, well, he got involved in wars and all kinds of stuff, and he was prime minister through three elections. Oh, on the face of it, is he going to get one of these? And I just feel a little bit like, yeah, we're now, not so much to do with Thatcher, we're now setting a precedent that we don't need to set.
Yeah, well, it's part of the big year in the UK between the Jubilee and the Olympics and a funeral. It's very and the wedding. It's very exciting. Yeah, like a lot of ceremonies. You know, it's all part of the theme.
Well, I guess we
could write a little book or movie that's, you know, it's going to be just about these year and a half.
You've cleared all the ornamental gun carriages out. You've got the horses
that's right.
trained.
They're very polished.
You've polished
might as
all,
well.
All the buckles. You might get them all out. It's still in the front of the warehouse. Just get them out and have it again.
Yeah, right.
If no one dies for a couple of years, they'll be in the back of the warehouse.
Yeah.
And then if Tony Blair, for example, was to pass away,
you're going to go to the guy who controls these kids and be like, listen, I appreciate it, but it's way in the back.
Yeah, exactly.
I mean, I haven't even checked, you know, if it works, if the tires are pumped
up. We didn't have it out since the Thatcher thing.
So, I was checking because...
to tie in with our marathon thing, apparently the Queen's Royal Barge that she had out for the Jubilee,
mm-hmm.
you know, where she goes out like some little boat.
Yeah.
That was out at the London Marathon today on the river. It was like, oh, Queen's Barge to make appearance at London Marathon.
It was
and
convenient.
That's because it's there. We've got it out. Yep,
it had been recently painted.
Let's get some miles out of it. Yeah.
yeah. So, you know, I checked because Ronald Reagan, you know, passed in 2004 and in America, they're all official state funerals because we don't really have kings, you know, so those are state funerals whenever you have that sort of stuff. And
I
couldn't figure out how much it cost.
Yeah, well, that's from the prime minister.
But that was actually the first one we'd had since LBJ passed away in the early 70s, Lyndon Baines Johnson, because Nixon had taken a pass and he was kind of like, yeah, man, you know.
Well, yeah, because you feel
it didn't end
bad,
that well, so you know, I'll skip that sort of thing. But nobody's passed away since, you know,
yeah,
and
no,
all our
you.
Presidents have been hanging around.
Well, didn't Ford pass away? Was he still alive?
Oh my God! Well,
if you know the answer to that, right? You'll win an Atlantic Voice mug if you know the answer to that.
Ooh, well, let's move. Or
was it maybe I'm? Yeah, let's move on. I don't want to get because he didn't even get voted in. Really, he doesn't really count. He's not legit.
He just sort of slipped in there.
Yeah, he was like a substitute teacher.
That's right.
Yeah.
Well, the other thing about the funeral that was sort of interesting to talk about transatlantic stuff is one of the speakers at the funeral was her granddaughter.
And I'd never heard of her.
Amanda Thatcher. She's it's kind of funny. One article said 19, another one said 20. But she's 19 or 20 years old. She is from Texas. Although, actually, I think she was raised in South Africa for a good amount of time. And then she went to Texas with her mother, who divorced from, I guess it was Mark Thatcher.
The brother. Mark Thatcher, no, he was a son.
Yeah.
Mark Thatcher to Margaret Thatcher was like Billy Carter to Jimmy Carter.
Oh, yeah. Well, you know, I'm reading up about this.
Yeah,
and so,
Roger Clinton,
to give a little background,
brothers
Mark Thatcher can't come to America because of charges stemming from his apparent involvement in a coup in Equatorial Guinea. And so he can't come here. And
with
somehow,
one of those guys who has coffee with Saddam Hussein in hell right now.
So somewhere along the process, I mean, I found this interesting. I didn't want to dig too far into Mark Thatcher, the fact that he had this whole thing. But like you said, it must have been a Billy Carter
type thing, you know, shady business deals, all kinds of stuff.
So Amanda's parents divorce. Mother moves to Texas, remarries. I'm not sure what the order of events was, but ends up in Texas. She's now going to school at the University of Richmond, is on the track team and all this sort of stuff.
And that is Richmond in America, not Richmond in Southwest
London.
Richmond,
Virginia, which is around the corner from us.
Good school, right?
Yeah, it's a pretty good school. Yeah. It's expensive. You know, it's a private school, although it's called University of Richmond. It's a private school. But she's there, and so she spoke at the funeral, and the papers in England just sort of fell all over themselves about
her. Okay, but they always have a reason for that.
She's slightly cute.
Well, that's the reason.
Yeah, and the fact that she basically, like, so the various articles, the repeated word was
it's like
flawless.
Kate Middleton's sister. I don't think she's very attractive, but she gets in the papers because it's like, what's the word phrase? Celebrity totty, I think is the phrase that we have back in England.
Yeah. I think, it's like, you know, it's like because they're in a position of power, it seems like a bigger deal when they're okay-looking
kind
of thing.
Yes,
And she's not in power or anything like that, but she has that celebrity aspect of what's going on. So anyway, these papers, like I think the Daily Mail said it was a pitch. By the way, it was a reading. It was not a speech. It was not written. It was a reading from the Bible.
All right.
So it wasn't even like she was...
Yeah,
any
like
words
she
that
had
she had come up with. It wasn't a eulogy type of thing.
Yeah,
she was just doing
she was
a reading
doing
at this sort of stuff. But, you know, it was pitch perfect. And the word that was repeated through multiple papers, the Mirror, Times, all this sort of stuff, was it was flawless. And one of them talked about...
Try doing this podcast without notes and then come back and tell me if your performance is pitch perfect.
That's right. And so the Guardian UK talked about how, she's telling these words with her Texas twang. And so I'm like, well, this would be kind of interesting if somebody's telling a Texas. So, you know, in keeping with some of our earlier audio stuff, I grabbed some audio on this stuff.
Okay.
We'll play for a second. Tell me if you hear any Texas twang in this. Or, for that matter, is she pitch perfect and flawless?
Okay.
Not against flesh and blood, but against principalities, against powers, against the rulers of the darkness of this world.
Boring.
All right, let me. I'm going to give the definitive word on her right now, and I will say this: I'm surprised that you actually even listened to the video of her, because I didn't. When I read in the papers that, Margaret Thatcher's granddaughter, I looked at a few pictures and I made my own judgment. Why? Because that was really, you know, I actually didn't bother listening to her. I'm going to say this. I sound like I'm from Texas more than she does.
Yeah, there's not a bit of Texas.
That's the most unconvincing Texan accent I've ever heard in my life.
Well, I don't think she's supposed to. I think, I assume what happened is somebody who was writing the article who...
Just looked at the picture.
Well, no, but they thought, it doesn't sound British. And so it must be Texas, like, it sounds so American. It's like when those of us here can't tell the difference between a Scottish accent or a London accent or Liverpool. You know, like, they sound so British.
Back in Britain.
This is, she sounds so Texan. She sounds American.
Back in Britain, an American accent basically is either everyone going, y'all, and that's it. And so, you know, it doesn't matter if you're from Minnesota or if you're from Seattle, Washington, or if you're from California. It doesn't matter. You're speaking with a Western twang or whatever it may be, because that's what we think everyone sounds like.
Yeah. So I thought that was kind of funny. I'm not dazzled. I don't think she's the future leader of the world based on her reading there. Even
what does
even
she do?
You
know, what's she studying? Is she going to get into politics?
I don't know. She's the family apparently is evangelical, heavy conservative. She did a mission in China. I think she was her high school class apparently voted her likely to rule the world. You know, one of those kind of superlatives.
Yeah,
so maybe she's got an inclination towards this sort of stuff. But
you need a bit more on your resume other than I won a couple of high school elections.
Yeah. So I think that's probably it on Maggie Thatcher.
Okay.
The Iron Lady.
The Iron Lady.
We managed to go through the whole thing without using the word Iron Lady for
what
her.
We have there, yeah. She inspired the rock band Iron Maiden.
Maybe, you know, in a way.
I don't know if
it's
true or not, but I wouldn't
I don't think the name,
me.
But I'm sure the Iron Maiden had something to say about
Margaret
Thatcher.
Yeah.
So back on other governments and their efforts.
Okay.
The American government, you know, this week in meteor news on the podcast. It's like we should do a niche. I was listening to some sort of thing about podcasting, and they were talking about niche podcasts and however. Look, clearly we do not have a niche podcast. We'll talk about whatever's there. But we seem to be developing one on meteors and other space debris.
Well, we like to follow up stories that we've done that have amused us. And I did see this. We've done a couple of episodes where we talked a little bit about the meteor attack that happened a couple of weeks ago in Russia, in fact, when we talked about
basketball
camps. Yep. And I saw this great headline. And then the great headline was, you know, NASA plan to lasso asteroid.
Mm-hmm.
And then underneath they'd said NASA plans to capture asteroid and study it. And that was exactly what I said. And I actually think it was in The Guardian, which is a website I get a lot of my news from. Or it may have been in The Washington Post. And I thought, what a great headline. They wanted to lasso, and they kept using that word.
Yeah.
They're going to lasso an asteroid and study it, like it was like a lion. Now, you'd made fun of me because I had attempted to impose human or animal qualities onto a rock. Like I kept saying there was a gang of them roaming the universe. Like they were, you know, they were sentient beings. All of a sudden, NASA are now legitimizing my position because they want to capture it and study it. If they capture the asteroid and put it in a big warehouse in Area 51 and watch it through the window, how will it behave? Will it drink coffee or will it drink tea? Will the asteroid just bounce around the warehouse, desperate to get out and run into something? What's NASA's plan?
Well, so they're calling it a lasso, but what it is like basically a big bag. You know, what they're looking for is an asteroid.
That doesn't sound impressive, though.
Well, it's like it's a fabric thing that they'll put out off of this thing, and it's going to be an unmanned satellite that would go out. And they haven't picked a particular candidate, but they're aiming for something that would be...
Oh, small enough, because you're going to need a pretty big bag.
You know, we talked all about, like, the types of things it's analogized to. This one of the newspaper articles said it would be dump truck-sized.
Okay.
You know, so
pretty
something
big,
like
yeah.
10 yards long or meters or whatever you want to do it there. But I thought the fact that they picked a dump truck, again, fits perfectly with it had to be something with heft. Like, it doesn't matter how – you can get the right size, but you need to not only describe the right size as well as give you the sense of heaviness. Just like it's washing machine sized and things like that instead of like you couldn't use any sort of thing that was – small and light kind of thing. It had to be a dump truck, you know, like that was the size of it.
I don't really see the point of capturing some wimpy asteroid.
No, well, I mean, all the asteroids are got that heft, but I mean, you could describe the size without saying it's the size like
a
heavy.
Well, no, but you can say either a dump truck size asteroid that we're going to capture, and you and I are going to sit here and go, oh, yeah, they're going to need a technology. But if you go an airship-like asteroid, you're going to go... Yeah, whatever.
Exactly.
You just send a space shuttle up, an astronaut can lean out, grab it, and just sort of push it back to Earth.
It does seem to
be. That's what I'm saying.
So they would get the dump truck-sized asteroid. They talked about it. They'd have to go out a million miles, which is about four times as far as the moon. And so we were talking about, I don't know, really, they roam all over. You know, we think about the asteroid belt. That's much further away. But this would be, you know, it'd be passing through.
And if we went out there and tried to take one, those other asteroids, they would take care of us in a hurry.
That's right.
You think they're going to allow that to happen?
Yeah, yeah. So this one, they would grab it, and it would be, you know, they tumble and stuff. And so it's designed to not only grab it, but cease its tumbling, like so that its torsional movement wouldn't wreck everything.
Okay.
But somehow it's supposed to grab the thing. But the best part, I didn't realize, you told this story about lassoing and bring it back and studying it. You know where they're bringing it to?
Area 51?
They want to put it in orbit around the moon. They would bring it to the moon.
So they want to put it in captivity.
They would let it go.
It's an astronaut.
They would
captivity.
Let it go around the moon, so it would be in orbit around the moon. And then they would send up manned spacecraft that could dock with it, cut off little pieces, and study it and all that sort of stuff.
All right, so let me equate this now. SeaWorld, they get dolphins and killer whales. They capture them, all right, sometimes in a big bag. They release it in SeaWorld, they study it, and then it does tricks. We're going to get an asteroid, we're going to put it in a bag, we're going to bring it to the moon, put it in orbit, study it, and then watch it do tricks.
Yep.
All right.
Pretty much there. And I mean, I'm
there's a reason why NASA's success rate is getting lower and lower. This is why.
Well, you know, it was announced as a part of it.
Because it's a rock.
Well, it was announced as a part of
a rock.
Well,
You hammered me for trying to give it, like, you know.
But, Zev, I mean, like,
it's a rock.
If
you just chop it up, yeah, well, you're worried, rock.
You're worried about the meteors attacking, right?
I am worried about it.
Like, if you're worried about the meteors attacking, you need to catch one and study it and figure out its ways.
Okay. All right, let's go back to our show.
And not only have to figure out its ways, but you have to figure out how to catch it, right? Like, I mean,
in a bag.
But you don't know it's going to work. If you wait until the one is going to crash into Earth and then you try to deploy the bag and you haven't done a test run yet,
let me tell you something.
Bad form. I mean, listen, if you're going to try and catch elephants, you need to go try to catch
those asteroids. Attacked the other week. They were smashing up Russian buildings, blowing up holes in the ground, the whole nine yards. I don't need NASA to be spending billions of dollars to send a couple of fellas in suits up there to chip away and go, it's a rock. I know it's a rock. I've just seen it smash up Russia.
Well, forget about the cutting up part. The go catching it part, right? Like, you want to wait until... I mean, are you some sort of asteroid appeaser that you will let these asteroids come and you're going to wait until the last minute to try to stand up to the asteroids? We need to tell the asteroids now what's going on, get control of them, and let them know. See, if you catch that asteroid, you know, you're talking about your asteroids.
I have a cautionary tale.
If you show you can catch one asteroid, the rest of the asteroids aren't coming after you. They're scared. They don't want to be snared.
I have a cautionary tale now. This week, when I get up in the morning, I turn on cable TV. All right, I get ready to go to work, but I watch the telly. Some days I watch the news, but this week, because of everything that was going on, I'm like, oh, I can't handle any more of that.
Uh-huh.
So I turn on one of the cable channels, and they're showing The Lost World, Jurassic Park 2. Here's my cautionary tale. We made dinosaurs. Oh, great, dinosaurs, aren't they cute? Then the dinosaur gets out of control. They're eating everyone, including Jeff Goldblum. Same thing's going to happen with the asteroid. You bring it back to Earth, you study it, oh, isn't it a nice, benign asteroid? Then it gets out of control, and it's smashing into Earth, and boom, we're right where the whole thing we were trying to avoid. Well, I say, them up on their way in, be done with it. Don't try and bring in, they can't be trained, they're not going to become man-friendly, they're asteroids.
I did think to myself, boom, I mean, how embarrassing would that be is if you bring it...
Would it be embarrassing?
You bring the asteroid back to the moon, and somehow you... I dropped it.
Here we go.
Folks down on Earth, watch out. Asteroid coming down, I dropped it. Sorry.
Armageddon 2, but without Bruce Willis, but still Ben Affleck. All right, because Ben Affleck, he lived through the first one. In Armageddon 2, Ben Affleck, he's in retirement with the girl, whatever she is, the one from Steven Tyler's daughter... They're living in retirement.
Live time.
Whatever. I think Steve Buscemi lived through Armageddon.
Uh-huh.
They're all in retirement. But in Armageddon 2, the asteroid that NASA have brought back to Earth gets out of control. And then we have to send Ben Affleck and the boys up to get it. Armageddon 2.
And when they go up...
I want you to write all that down. Send it to Hollywood. Our next episode will be from Hollywood, where we are working for MGM or whoever.
And when they get up there, they find out that Bruce Willis didn't die.
He's living on the other asteroid.
He got onto the other asteroid.
Yes, boom. What's his name in Star Wars was turned into the metal, the rock, and then he came back alive.
Yeah.
Your boy Harrison Ford.
So, you know, part of this stuff has been they've been putting it out because it's really part of a budget thing. Is what they're trying to do is put out programs that people will get behind.
Yeah, and they're blowing their budget on this nonsense.
Well, you know, they actually, they apparently, I don't know if they do surveys or what they did, they tested some other ideas that did not sell as well.
Like going to Mars?
Yeah, I can't remember what the other one was, but
one was they wanted to make water on the moon. Like, we don't have enough water on Earth.
Well, a few congressmen came out who must be on, like, the right committee, and they said, we don't want to focus on this. We want to focus on moon colonization.
Oh, are you kidding me?
And let me tell you something. When people colonized different parts of the Earth, it was because there was good stuff there. Like, when they came over to America to colonize, it was because there's natural resources and things like that. You know, you don't colonize nothing, right? I mean, like, why would you, hey, let's go colonize the place that has no air,
because you want to get
gravity, this sort of stuff like that. Well, but sure, we're not sending, like, a religious group up to the moon. That's the other version. The other version is you're pushing people away,
Australia,
or they're trying to get away from prosecution or persecution. That's not the way it would work. So in any event, I'm fine with the effort. I'm sure it's not going to happen this way, but, you know, this is a little study of asteroids. Never hurt anybody.
Yep, asteroids. So... Yeah, we're still on. We're still big asteroid fans.
Yeah, well, that's this week in asteroid news.
But again, the bottom line is NASA have endorsed my opinion. that these things, they're not just lifeless.
You just
rocks.
Don't like the way they're implementing.
They've got
it.
A mind of their own, these asteroids, and you've got to be one. You've got to be vigilant.
But you don't like their approach, so you can't.
Well, right now their approach, you know, going to be from behind when you're not watching.
No, I meant you don't like the approach NASA's of NASA. Approach, sorry. Like, you like the fact that they're concerned about the issue. You just don't think they're doing the right thing about it.
I think they should just don't take any chances. Blow them up. Otherwise, they're escaping in captivity. We've got Jurassic Park.
All right. Well, we'll send that vote in to our NASA representative. I don't know what that is, but
sports.
Sports news. Which one did you want to talk about first? Talk about the cheater, the golf cheater.
Let's talk about the cheater. We also did a cheat of the week episode about way back. And again, this is our moment to stop and self promote. If you've recently just caught the podcast, please go back and listen to our other old back episodes. You can find them all on iTunes. We are free.
Yeah, we've got episodes talking about Lance Armstrong, about Oscar Pistorius, and other various cheats.
But those were different weeks.
Yeah, they were. So that's what I'm saying. We covered it in different places, so you have to listen to both.
Tiger Woods. Tiger Woods got caught cheating at the Masters.
Yeah, so I want to try this out. I don't know what your answer will be, but could you actually explain, without getting into the technical stuff too far,
what happened?
What'd he do?
All right, so Tiger Woods is playing golf. He hits the ball in the water. In golf, you get to drop another ball, but it's cost you a couple of strokes. The catch is you have to drop it basically where you hit it from or on a line that your ball traveled before it went in the water. Tiger Woods doesn't. He drops it further back. Now, while you may go, well, that's harder, it's against the rules. Tiger Woods then hit his shot. He had violated it. He violated the rule that you have to drop it where you hit it from. He moved it further back. Probably to get a better view, maybe. I don't know.
I think he said he actually came on and he said it was because it was better for his club length. Like, because
So he cheated. Here's the interesting thing about this whole business. No one noticed. No one there goes, ooh. The guy he's playing with doesn't go, ooh, I think you've just cheated there. Tiger Woods' caddy doesn't go, ooh, I don't think you're allowed to do that. The referee who's walking around with him doesn't blow the whistle and go, oop, violation, free kick. Tiger Woods comes in, signs his card, he's ready to go home. But by that time, some Joe sitting at home has called in to go, oh, don't you know he's cheated? And then they had to retroactively go back and punish him. I find it fascinating that you can be done in by some guy at home.
Well, I understand it's even more complicated than that. I understand that. So the guy calls in.
Well, he should
in,
have been disqualified.
Well, the guy calls in and says that, right? And the rules committee, apparently, during the event, without talking to Tiger, had actually sort of considered that and concluded it wasn't worse. But then Tiger goes on the air and he talks about when he dropped.
Because he didn't know that he cheated.
Well, he says, I dropped because I would have a better club length and blah, blah. So he doesn't even realize it apparently, but he's confessing to the fact that he was improving his situation. And then the rules committee goes, oh, wait, if that's why you did that, then that's a rule violation, which meanwhile turns into a card violation, because then he submits a card.
He said the wrong score.
But now there's a rule that they implemented in the last year that says when you do that and you really didn't know you were doing it, you're not automatically disqualified. So then they say, no disqualification as it all turns out. I think they additionally penalized him for that day. Like they added a penalty, two strokes or something like that, which is what
pushed them back in. That's what they decided to do.
But they said not disqualified kind of thing.
This is interesting for Tiger Woods. You'd think he would know now that this whole I didn't know I was doing anything wrong excuse, that doesn't fly.
Because
the last time he tried that, his missus backed up the car and hit it, smashed it to pieces with a golf club. I didn't know I was doing anything wrong.
I think the most important question, right? You go through all these steps.
He should have been disqualified. That's the bottom line. And he didn't because he was Tiger Woods. I don't care what anyone says. He is still, regardless of how you feel about him, love him or loathe him, he is still the biggest name in that sport. And you don't kick him out for something that, at the time, nobody caught, except for this guy sitting at home, watching telly and deciding to call it.
I'm sure it's multiple people. I think it's funny that it's that interactive piece. But here's what I think about it. It's all these technical levels to what's going on. Okay. All these sort of steps are happening.
There's layer upon layer of violation.
Exactly. It hit the post. It goes out. It does a drop. It's the wrong drop. The people notice it. They don't notice it.
Wrong
they call
scoreboard.
In. He confesses on the air. They do a penalty. They take advantage of this rule. Does this prove he's using steroids? This is my thing. I'm looking at Tiger Woods. And people have been talking about it on and off and stuff like that, right?
Yes, because his muscles got so big, they collapsed his brain.
How willfully ignorant... No, I don't mean whether it actually proved it. But listen, here's the great thing. I think, you know, I'm jumping on a bandwagon. I was off the bandwagon. I was behind the times on Lance Armstrong. I'm jumping on the bandwagon now, and I'm saying Tiger Woods is using steroids. So this way, when it all comes out, I was ahead of the curve, and I knew that this was going on beforehand.
Okay, so let me get this concise now for our listeners. You are claiming that Tiger Woods is cheating. You're not quite sure how. It just doesn't seem right to you. But what's most convincing to you that he's cheating is because you don't want to be caught behind with the Lance Armstrong thing, where I was saying for a decade he was cheating, and no one believed me. And now I have the ultimate victory of being the smartest guy.
That's right. I'm betting
you're
early on this
you're
one.
Just
I'm
going early.
I'm getting this sort of stuff. It has nothing to do with whether the stuff of the events and things like that. I'm just saying.
Well, actually, no.
He's too big for a golfer. And
he's too big for a golfer. Look at this time when he cheated. We've got proof. There's something going on here.
No,
if it walks like a duck and it talks like a duck. Well,
I was actually trying to create a non sequitur, like all this sort of technical stuff. But here's the real question.
Okay.
I've been wanting to ask that question for a while. It's like, do you think he might be on steroids? Because I was thinking about this.
Well, I think he's
and
on steroids.
This has come on. This has come up right now, and they do have drug testing, although not
in
for
golf?
HGH. Yep, and they do have drug testing.
Really?
Now I don't know what the detail of the program is. No, in fact, he was big in favor of the program a number of years ago, and I think they put it into place in like 2010 or something like that, but in any event. But I thought to myself, see, unlike the Lance Armstrong thing where he could dodge these tests, but he has teammates. You know, there's so many more people involved in it.
Yes.
In golf, if you have all the money that you could dodge it, you can get the right doctors that you could do that sort of stuff, you don't have all these people looking over what you're doing. You don't have teammates that are looking at
stuff.
You can get
away with
it. How easy would it must be very easy to cheat and do that sort of stuff. And, you know, like I said, I'm getting ahead of the curve.
Right, so
I'm going to say he's on steroids.
Your case is even weaker than the case I made against Lance Armstrong a decade ago, but...
That's right.
Whatever. You just want to be right.
Maybe a casino has long odds for it. It'd be I go ahead and bet on it now. Just
is he
going to
get
the long
for
odds
cheating?
Kind of thing?
Well, no. But that's the thing, though. You can't bet on is he going to get done for cheating because he just got done for cheating.
Right. Well, no. I can bet on whether we find out he's on steroids
right.
and
Fair
stuff
enough.
Like
I'll
that.
Give you that.
So that was my big insight from the golf.
Fair enough.
It was a good Masters.
But let me say this now because we were going to talk a little bit about here in America. NBC have the rights for the Premier League for next season. And NBC are going to be going wall to wall.
Next three seasons.
Next three seasons. Basically, I can see more Premier League soccer on TV for a very cheap price living 3,000 miles away from England than I can if I was back in England.
Next year, you will be able to see
every single game.
Not even like you'd have to pay for an extra package. As long as you get NBC Sports Network, even on days where there's too many... First of all, they're going to put games on when they have... a bunch of games at the same time, which is, you know, people may not know that, but there's a lot of games they put on at the same time, unlike, well, I guess there's a lot of games.
It's just like the NFL,
the 4 o'clock game. There's fewer, it spreads out better, but in any event, you'll be able to see all the games. Actually, that's kind of ironic, too, is that you'll be able to see all the English Premier League games. You can't see all the NFL games unless you buy one of these extra packages, which I think you can only get on DirecTV. So
we'll get some of these games for free, won't we? Like a person who doesn't have a cable package or satellite package will be able to get.
Yeah, there's going to be some games on NBC
now,
proper.
Like I said, well, back in the UK, you can't watch a live game. You only get like a couple of international games, but you can't watch like a regular week at a Premier League. You don't get any games for free. You get highlights, but you don't get any games for free.
In America, as long as you get, first of all, there'll be some games on regular NBC, so you could just get it broadcast.
That's what I'm saying.
But also NBC Sports Network, as long as you have that, not only will they have games on CNBC, USA, MSNBC, E.
Oh, E.
All NBC Universal properties. But they'll actually have a slate of extra, they call them Premier League Extra Time.
Oh,
so, like, if there's enough games that they can't fit them on those channels, they'll have, you know, like on your cable system, there's
a bunch of slots. So, wait a minute. You're telling me that Top Chef and Fashion Runway are going to get preempted for Manchester City, Wigan?
They'll run them in a split screen, I think.
But those are I like those other shows.
Well, you can see them later on. And those shows only get run
like 12
times.
Would I rather watch Carlos Tevez or Heidi Klum? Heidi Klum, I'm sorry. Or Klum.
Well, if you...
Klum, I don't know, whatever it is.
The one that you weren't sure what nationality was.
Yeah, whatever. Swedish Tang. Well, I don't...
She's German. We had this debate earlier in the week, not on the air, but Zeph thought she was Swedish, but she's German. Any event...
They all look alike.
Right.
They're all blonde.
So they'll be on all the channels. No, you'll be able to get all those games. Well, plus those shows
So like the golf, will I now be able to call in and affect the outcome of games? Because this is where these two stories, to me, tie together. I think it's as much I love the Premier League. I think it's fascinating now that, like I say, in the United States, 3,000 miles away from where the actual thing is taking place and where the bulk of its fans are, I can see every game on TV here, living 3,000 miles away from my country of birth. The golf thing, the Tiger Woods thing, the most fascinating thing, all jokes aside, about that was the fact that he got done in by a viewer sitting at home. Someone sitting at home, just watching the telly, picked up the phone, and potentially had an effect on the outcome of one of the greatest golf tournaments. Are you kidding me?
Well, that's standard practice nowadays.
But it shouldn't be.
Why not?
Well, then why can't I call up and go, you know, I just saw the replay on TV, and what's-his-face there was definitely offside. We need to stop the game and chalk the goal off.
Well, because golf, you can make those judgments after the fact. You can't do that in the other sports.
It doesn't matter. This notion of you're a fan, you're not a participant.
I'm just amazed. Listen, I don't want to go back to the Tiger one too much. But,
no, because he's cheated anyway, so it's a moot point. But
I'm amazed that whatever phone number that these people find the call in, that anybody answers it. I mean, like, you know, it's just not like out. You have to take the call.
That's true. Yeah, it's true.
I don't understand what that... You just don't have an open line and, you know, somebody says, hey, I want to complain about the rules. Just hang up on them. Who
cares? The fella sitting by the phone, he'd gone to Starbucks at 2 o'clock. He hadn't got a decaf. He'd had to have regular coffee. He's all wired up at 5 o'clock. The phone rings. He goes, oh, yep. And it's Joe Blow in Omaha going, you know, Tiger Woods, just blah, blah, blah. That's what it was.
So NBC, they got these sports stuff. They're paying $250 million for the 3 years, which is three times what Fox, who has the current American contract, paid. I mean, there's a big thing in TV now because everybody has DVRs and doesn't watch commercials that sports are premium property now because you actually get people to watch it live and they'll end up watching your commercials.
Yes.
And so that's why the sports networks, the TV networks are falling all over themselves to get sports properties. And so they've really bid this thing up quite a bit. It might be fine. They announced their announcing teams, which seem reasonable. I mean, we don't need to get in all the details in there. I mean, as long as the studio is not being run by Bob Costas and Mary Carrillo with their Olympic-type fluff
stories and things like that.
Like, I don't need, like, special interest stories about Liverpool's, you know, special fan who, you know, is...
Or John Terry running
their head on backwards or something like
John
that.
John Terry running his orphanage. Right. For mislaid youth.
I'm sure he runs an orphanage. That sort of thing. You do kind of wonder what kind of flavor putting on an NBC is going to have. You know, and I was thinking...
But will they do anything? They'll just stick the game up.
Well, they're supposed to have 30 hours of original programming per week on Premier League. So in addition to the games, they're going to have multiple shows like talking about the game. They're going to have something called... I think it's like 72 hours. It's like where they would record a team for 3 days leading up to a match, kind of like they do with the NFL teams where they do it all season, the preseason stuff. They're supposed to be doing something like that. They're doing cut-down games of the big four teams or something, or six teams, where on Mondays and Tuesdays they'll do like synopsized version of the game so you can watch the Man U, Man City.
I'm looking forward to that.
Arsenal.
I won't have to sit through too many miserable Arsenal performances. I can just watch the five-minute version.
It's funny. One night is apparently going to be only Man U and Man City, and then the other night's supposed to be Chelsea, Arsenal, Spurs.
Like a London night.
Yeah, like it's going to be all the other games. But the sort of cut-down version of the game. They're doing a lot. They're rolling a lot of stuff out there. It'll be interesting. So, you know, they're supposed to have the whole studio stuff.
Now, where's all this money going? Is this being kicked straight back to the teams? I mean, a lot of it is...
I don't know.
I guess. Well, if the Premier League take it...
What's the Premier League's arrangements for... TV contracts. Because the teams don't have, even in England,
the teams
don't have independent.
Yeah, it's
TV
not like
contracts.
Here where teams have, you know, like baseball
their
teams cut their own networks and cut their own deals. I think all that money goes straight into the Premier League and then the Premier League divvy it up to the teams. Now, how it's divvied up to the teams, I think this has always been one of the arguments, and I think it's the same in any sport. There are some teams who believe that people watch them, so they should get more money. And I know in England, and it's no different than here in America. A team such as, just for example, Manchester United always think they should get more money than Queen's Park Rangers because people turn on the TV to watch Manchester United. In the same way, in this country, the Dallas Cowboys or the New York Yankees believe in their respective support sports that people turn on the TV to watch us. So why aren't we getting more of that money? Because we're actually the reason that your property is worth what it's worth.
Well, and here they can write their own contracts so they can get extra money, although not less so in NFL, but more so in baseball. Obviously, you can do your own thing. And Notre Dame has done their own thing for TV purposes.
The long and short of it is I don't know how that money is divvied up.
Yeah. Well,
but it is a huge amount of money that's going to go, that will find its way into the teams. And you would imagine, and it makes sense, If a TV station in America are paying all this cash, then it better goes back to the teams so that those teams can go out and go and buy the best players and pay the best players so that back in America or wherever else or in Asia where apparently the whole Asian gambling market is driven by the Premier League so that, you know, they're getting something for their money. I just find it amazing. I would never, when I first came to America nearly 30 years ago, I couldn't get anything on TV. Couldn't get anything. I had to buy a newspaper 2 days later to find out what happened at the weekend. Or I would tune in my old radio to the super long wave band to hear the BBC World Service. It is amazing now that, like I say, I can sit here 3,000 miles away from the borough of my birth and see my team a lot more on TV than I can back in that city. I just find that amazing.
Yeah, it's pretty interesting. It's the oddities of the marketplace.
And yet my team now suck. And why would I want to watch them?
Why do you want to watch them anymore? Well, listen, they're still in contention for the Champions League slots. So they're all right. Well, you know, so it is interesting to think about all the TV being dedicated to this stuff. The Premier League has become very sort of trendy. You know, like it's a different sort of sports base and probably attractive for advertisers because it's a relatively upmarket, educated fan base here.
People that have traveled.
You know, all this stuff. And it's weird, like, you know, basically everybody, like, picks a team that they're going to be a fan of. Unlike you, I don't have any reason to have picked a particular team. Somebody somewhere along the line said, you'd like this team. And I checked them out. Yeah, I like that team. I've now adopted that team. Had nothing to do with a hometown.
It's worked out all right for you.
Yeah.
Definitely better than the deal I've got.
I originally picked Chelsea in part because they had Coors on their chest, and back then they weren't there in the Premier League, but they weren't winning. And so, like, you know, I feel a little bit ahead of the curve. I did not just jump on the bandwagon with Jose Mourinho. But so it's sort of interesting that it's all – I wonder how long it'll last. I mean, there was a phase a few years ago where NASCAR, obviously a different – segment, but it became a big, like, everybody started watching NASCAR, and then all that stuff tapered off. I mean, their races now, like, they were all sold out on a regular basis, and the races are not sold out anymore. And I do wonder whether that the Premier League's going through this phase 5 years from now. Well, it's not like it'll go away, but is it going to be NBC will be looking at this contract and going, paid a little bit too much for that?
I think it's like anything. I think TV companies are always searching for the next big thing. And I think right now the Premier League seems like a hot thing, so you pay money for it. And in 5 years' time, rugby or lacrosse or something else from somewhere else is going to be the next big thing. And it's that old thing. If you put it on, people watch it. People want to watch it, so you put it on. It is a vicious circle.
And, of course, NBC is, you know, hurting. I mean, like, they
because all their other shows
suck. Shows are done. And then their ratings are horrible. They've got serious revenue problems and things like that. And so, in fact, I was, you know, as a joke, I was trying to look at shows that were on NBC currently for which you could have a tie-in to the Premier League, some sort of jokey tie-in.
All right.
There aren't any shows on. Like, I looked at the primetime schedule on NBC, and The Voice is on, like, three times a week. They've got lots of Law and Orders of various stripes. You know, like, I guess you could use that.
Well, you could use that in the Premier League.
Saturday
John
Night
Terry,
Live.
Luis Suarez.
Yeah. Saturday Live, I don't know if you noticed this, now runs twice every Saturday.
Oh, really?
You know, so they run, like, the last weeks or a couple of weeks before in the early, or, like, the hour and a half slot before the actual regular, I guess, before the news, and then they switch back over to the regular Saturday Live. And so, I mean, there's nothing to put on the air kind of thing.
I did hear that they were threatening. There was an internet rumor this week that there was going to be a Friends reunion. And people were like, oh, Friends reunion. That tells you how they're hurting for shows on NBC.
That show, right? When you watch repeats of Seinfeld, you know, at one point it was Seinfeld opened up for Friends. You know, Seinfeld came along first, but Seinfeld was like the lead in, I guess, to Friends, or was it vice versa? Whatever it was. But the Seinfeld episodes you watch now, and there's some parts that are goofy. I mean, I love all the episodes where crazy things happen that if you had a cell phone now, you'd be able to solve it in about 2 seconds, you know, kind of thing. Hey, it's called, hey, look, oh, you're over there. I don't have to worry about this stuff anymore. So there's certain things that make it dated, but the humor generally holds up. Whereas the Friends stuff, when you watch a Friends episode now, it is horrible, horrible show. Like, it just was so... I mean, maybe it was that bad at the time, and I just felt like it was, hey, look at these cool, like, post-college, you know, kind of hanging around. But it's very goofy, and so I did think, like, listen, if you can't tie in the shows to current shows, maybe you can tie in the Premier League to new shows, you know? And maybe all the coaches one day all wear Cosby sweaters, you know?
Oh,
like,
yeah,
they can
all
do that sort of thing, like a theme thing, or you could use the cheer set. I don't know if they have the cheer set somewhere on Mothballs. You could use that as the set for the, like, in-studio show.
Okay.
And you maybe get up Norman Cliff at the corner bantering about, you know, Man U versus Man City kind of thing, you know, on the corner there talking about their teams.
So Alex Ferguson potentially could end up sitting there wearing a baseball cap that says The Voice on the
that's right.
So that
he'd be sitting, chair and he presses the big button, he spins around and he says, this jacket's too big on me, I can't figure it out.
They do have a Britain Loves Talent. I was going to make a joke about, like, someone could wear a hat saying America Loves Talent, and then, I don't know. I don't know. That just completely went up. No, Arsene Wenger could wear a hat that says America Loves Talent, and then his shirt would be, but none of them want to play for Arsenal.
Yeah, right.
That might be it.
He's got enough room on that jacket for, like, a whole billboard. Ski jacket thing that he's still wearing.
Anything else on the Premiership?
No, I think that's it.
That's it. We've packed in a lot this week.
Yeah, yeah.
So let me see some in-house. Oh, you've taken a picture of your fajita.
Yeah, a recent fajita trip, although it's from this, again, I have to say my resolution has been playing out with me just eating a lot of fajitas at the same restaurant rather than multiple restaurants, but that's part of the way towards
a
resolution.
To celebrate that, we are going to put a picture of Eric's dinner up on the blog. I've seen the picture. It's very nice. There's a lovely little piece of fresh lime in the middle of your fajita.
Yes, and I got a little beer that's like facing the camera and all that sort of stuff. And you know, my regular fajita place is not. It's not fancy, but you can tell, like, boy, these are fajita, you know, the steel, the metal pans that they heat up and stuff like that. It looks well worn.
All right, good. So at least that's one resolution that's rolling along sort of the semi-consistently. You had your cooking lesson the other week.
Yeah.
I'm sure we'll do some Star Wars sometime in the future. We've saved that for another time.
The news just keeps coming, so we're going to get to that sort of stuff. In the meantime, of course, we're on the iTunes now, so if you aren't listening to us on there already, make sure you do.
We do have another episode, like I say, of our trip around the National Recording Registry. We have one more episode to come. We're giving you a break this week, but a week from now, or any time after you've listened to this, there will be our third episode.
It's the modern music one, basically. Modern music. 80s and on music kind of thing, so maybe the most timely for everybody. If you've sat through all the other two, you get this one as a treat.
It's got some REM, some U2, all kinds of modern bands, so that should be a lot of fun. Anything else? Twitter?
The Twitter things are @Atlantic_voice, of course.
I do want to make one request, because I've actually been passing out the business cards that you made for us a lot. Mm-hmm. If you are a new listener, please email us your email address, and we will add you to our email list so you get notified when our episodes come out. Or, like I say, just follow us on Twitter.
If you do the iTunes, it's like an automatic subscription, so it downloads to you automatically. You can also do that through RSS feeds and things. And, of course, email us at atlanticvoice@gmail.com. And if you want to see the blog, which is really nothing but podcast posts now, is atlanticvoice.net.
That's it. This is the Atlantic Voice.
Take care.
You have been listening to the Atlantic Voice podcast. Follow us at atlanticvoice.net. Email us atlanticvoice@gmail.com or follow us on Twitter @Atlantic_voice. The Atlantic Voice, 3,000 miles of opinion.